On this episode of Skeptico,
Dr. Kelvi Perosetti, you've put together this program, educational program, and you've hinted at why you think there's a scientific reason to believe that this can be effective in helping people overcome grief and bereavement. You make the point that you get out of it what you put into it. And you say that's not just a kind of good axiom, but that there's scientific evidence for the fact that if you work at this, you're likely to have results. But if you don't work at it as much, you're less likely to have results.
Excuse me, that's exactly what happens in cognitive therapy. If you do not identify your wrong, distorted, excessively negative thoughts, and if you do not work at correcting them, your moods do not improve. On the other hand, we have research, particularly by Kenneth Ring. He showed something which I found phenomenally interesting, and it's fueled my enthusiasm for the approach I developed. We all know that NDEs show an array of psychological, beneficial psychological and behavioral changes after an NDE. What was extraordinary is that Ring showed that some of these changes appeared in people who did not have an NDE, but just read about it.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and on this episode, someone who has been recommended to me several times over the years. I don't know why it took me so long to get around to contacting Dr. Piero Kelvi Perosetti, but he's really done some terrific work in the area of education around near-death experience and grief. I think the interview flows pretty nicely and is self-explanatory. I don't need a lot of introduction here. Let's get right to the dialogue. Today we welcome Dr. Piero Kelvi Perosetti, an Italian-born, Scottish-raised MD who since 2004 has developed an intense scholarly interest in evidence suggesting the survival of consciousness after death. He's written some terrific books on the subject, including 21 Days into the Afterlife, a book from 2008 that received quite a bit of very positive attention. And recently, Dr. Kelvi Perosetti has turned his attention to grief and bereavement. And that's one of the things we want to talk to him a lot about today. So, Piero, welcome to Skeptico. Thanks so much for joining me. I hope you don't mind me using Piero, but I will stumble over Kelvi Perosetti too many times for my audience to survive.
I do not mind in the least, Alex, and it is such a great pleasure for me talking to you. As I've told you in our email exchanges, I'm pretty sure I've listened to every single one of the more than 250 episodes, and I make no mystery of the fact that the interviews and Skeptico and your own way of asking questions has contributed to my own thinking and its development over the years. So I'm really very, very happy to be talking to you today.
Well, that's super nice of you to say, and I'm so glad we have that common background to go from. Maybe we can make a good interview out of that. So, you know, one of the places I wanted to start with, because in going over your material that you sent me and that I found and I've come across before, which I always thought was really interesting, is, you know, you seem to have this drive to be a people helper. And I mean, that's so awesome. It's really not in me. I mean, I look at people like you and I go, what's going on here? But it seems like from a pretty early point in your career, you had this idea that you wanted to help people on a large scale, whether it's with the Red Cross or in disadvantaged countries, and now your work in grief and bereavement. So not just saying, oh, just patting you on the back and saying what a great guy you are, which I'm sure you are a great guy, but have you ever thought about what's up with that for you? Why were you drawn to kind of large-scale people helping is the only way I can think about it.
It is a very interesting question. It doesn't have to be large scale. It's a desire to help that's been with me forever, and I really have no particular explanation. I had an absolutely ordinary childhood, and I was raised in an ordinary family, no particular experiences. But it's true that I've always had it in me to try to make out of any situation, of any area of activity, something that I could be helpful with. And probably that drove my decision then to go for medical studies. And then, you know, if you have that in you, the job I've been at for many years, now many years ago, gives you the possibility of doing that on a scale that's truly extraordinary, because when you work in humanitarian affairs, your patient is not an individual anymore, is a large population made up of 100,000, 500,000, over a million at some stage in my that professional career. I was responsible for 1.1 million people. And that, you know, in terms of satisfying your need for being of help was quite something, yes. But I mean, that's in the past. And it is true that once my interest for cyclical research was born and then developed relatively early on, I thought that, but I mean, after all, what I'm learning, what I seem to have understood, is of potential immense benefit for a lot of people. And hence I moved into what we call today applied psychical research, which is a sub niche within the small niche of psychical research.
And then further, you've kind of turned your focus towards grief and bereavement, which I think is fantastic. And I love, because it's so necessary. There is such a need. And it takes that kind of background and that kind of empathy for someone to say, I'm going to go there, because a lot of people don't like to go there, right? I mean, it is, as a therapist also, which you are, you understand that there's the burnout factor too, you know, in dealing with people that are there, but you're not afraid to go there. But because I like to talk about science so much on Skeptico, I thought what we'd do is pull back a little bit from that and talk about the science of it, because you make some terrific points about, first of all, about bereavement and grief in general, about what we know about it, and then connecting it to a lot of this other research you've done on survival of consciousness. So can you walk us down that path?
Yes, let me just very, very briefly make a point of semantics, if I may, because I'm very uncomfortable in being termed a researcher. I'm not a researcher. I do not produce original material. I do not go out in the field or in the lab and produce original material myself. So you call me a scholar. Perhaps a scholar is a big word, but I'm a student. I'm an evolved amateur scholar, if you want, of psychical research. As many people as yourself and many people we talk to, you know, we read, we learn, we try to make sense of what.
Right, right. But let me interject here. And I appreciate where you're coming from. It's an important distinction. I'll try and stay there. You are a medical doctor. You went through all that training. You did rounds. You saw patients. You did that kind of stuff. You're extremely well qualified to do that. And then when you turned your attention to this, it seems to me like you turned your attention with that focus of being, you know, a professional, scientifically oriented, minded kind of person. So I just want to make sure people know that you're not just somebody who read a lot of really cool blog posts and read some good books and all that stuff.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And don't forget, although, I mean, it's not very interesting for our audience, but I mean, for the last 15 years, in fact, I've been a university lecturer. So I've grown used to that kind of thinking and looking at problems in a way that can be easily communicated and explained to others. And so if I cannot explain something to somebody else, then I still have my own homework to do. Back for a second, if we may, to the thing of grief and bereavement. My studies have told me that we are not in a good place when we talk about what's available in terms of grief and bereavement counseling. The traditional approaches, which are on offer, that's practically the only thing that's available today, or at least it has been until very, very recently, are the traditional psychological talk therapy-based counseling approaches. Be it Freudian, be it either kind of orientations or approaches, but that's what's available. Moreover, most of these are based on the dreaded concept of the stages of grief, originally proposed by Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, the Swiss psychiatrist. And she said, no, listen, you got this wrong. I proposed this for stages of acceptance of death. And you have moved those to the stages of grief. And now this has invaded all sectors of our life. And you talk about the stages of grief of, you know, losing your job, of after a divorce. So we have a conceptual model which is wrong, and it was actually denied by its own originator. And that's applied to hundreds of thousands, millions of people who are in pain over the loss of a loved one. And I tell you what, surprise, surprise, research tells us that these traditional approaches to grief counseling add very little, if anything, to the resources of the people themselves. And actually, certain studies say that in certain cases, these traditional approaches can do more harm than good. And that's really not very good. So that's the first term of the equation for me in the history of the development of my thinking in this respect. We have, on the one hand, traditional counseling, psychotherapy approaches, which are not effective at best.
So let me just interject something, Peter, because I think I want to really nail down this point from a scientific standpoint. So when we look at the literature, and we say there is something identifiable as grief and bereavement, we study it a bunch of different ways. We pay medical insurance, is reimbursed for it. People go to a therapist, they get treatment for it. Sometimes that therapist refers them to antidepressant medication because those are the symptoms they're reporting to. We study all this. Now, at the same time, because you've walked this other path, there is this kind of nagging little point in the background that, you know, grief and bereavement shouldn't really even totally exist in a completely materialistic, reductionistic kind of view of the world. But we'll leave that aside for a minute. The point, mm-hmm, I guess I just want to emphasize is that this is something that, from a medical standpoint, we've identified and we're working on, if you will. And I just wanted to really emphasize that point, because what you're now proposing with this course that you've done and your work in general is, hey, you've already identified the problem. All I'm doing is trying to measure whether what I'm doing is more efficacious or not efficacious in addressing the problem. You haven't invented the little check mark on the insurance form for what they're being treated for.
No, but it's correct. But I think that we're going too fast here, because I was trying to build my case in saying that we have, I mean, grief is the most universal of human experiences, right? Grieving and suffering after a loss is an absolutely universal experience. That's one thing. The other thing is that the approaches to take care of that are normally on offer, research tells us, are not effective, are not efficacious. The third point, and here comes a little personal part of the equation, because about 15 years ago, I suffered from a bout of severe depression. I was living in the US at the time.
That'll do it. No, I'm just kidding.
No. And I was frankly suicidal. And what literally saved my life was cognitive behavior therapy. And it's important to point this out, because what CBT taught me, apart from literally saving my life, is that the way we feel depends entirely on the way we think. Our moods are dependent on our thoughts. And now you have the two, you can put one and one together, or two and two together. If you're a bereaved person and you think that your loved one has disappeared, as vaporized, as completely vanished into some sort of black nothingness, the resulting mood is severe grief, depression. If you think that in some way we do not understand that loved one is still quote unquote alive, your mood is a lot better. I keep saying that there's no approach, there's no therapy, there's no way of thinking which will take away the totality of the pain of the loss. That's unthinkable. But it is true that by rationally looking at the evidence we have from about a dozen different fields of investigation, pointing towards the fact that, again, in a way we do not understand, we seem to survive physical death, we can correct our thoughts and feel less bad. Based on this, you know, afterlife science plus cognitive behavior approach, I and my friends at the Forever Family Foundation put together this resource that's actually coming out as we speak, which combines a cognitive behavior based self-help manual and a series of video lessons and video assignments, in which I, as I say, as a 15-year university lecturer of 15 years, try to make as clear a case for a rational belief in the afterlife as I can.
So let me recap, make sure I got this. So you're drawing the link between cognitive behavioral therapy, which we know from the research is extremely effective for a number of identifiable kind of conditions, but it's kind of a fancy word, but what it really is saying is knowledge is power a lot of times. So it's saying analyze what you know, look at perhaps challenging some of those beliefs with new information, and then that can sometimes lead to different thought processes that lead to different feelings, beliefs, behaviors, that whole cycle. We get that. So what you've made the connection to in a really great way is just saying, okay, well, here's a problem that we see, in that we're kind of indoctrinated in this culture that tells us over and over again, especially from a medical standpoint, you know, you can only imagine, we can have our private beliefs, even our spiritual beliefs. Some people have religious beliefs that are in a line with survival of consciousness. But I'll tell you, when you walk into that emergency room, a lot of that stuff just goes poof out the window, and you have this overlay that says, no, 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 none of that's true. And I kind of think that also comes into play with your kind of re-education kind of thing. Do you see that at all in terms of what you're, I don't want to say what you're up against exactly, but
Hello. I mean, I've got people, patients telling me, you know, I myself had an experience, an undeniable experience of after-death communication. I spoke about that with my grief counselor, and basically they wanted to lock me up, right? Or prescribe an antidepressant or you know, an antipsychotic drug. That is the experience of millions. And you have this dichotomy, what I would call almost cognitive dissonance, is that you talk to a grief counselor, a psychiatrist or a psychologist, and they want to lock you up. Then you move ward. You talk to a resuscitation doctor, or particularly a nurse or a caretaker working in an ICU, And for them, survival is a matter of every day. Is a direct experience they have all the time. So do not think that the health profession is monolithic in that refusal, because there's a lot of people who are seeing this with their own eyes day in and day out. So,
well, they're only monolithic in terms of how they, what they outwardly project and their talking points, because I think you're right. But, you know, so just to be clear, you're saying if you go to the hospice ward of the hospital and you talk to the nurses, and you mentioned, gee, do you think there's any ever this after-death communication thing has anything to it? And they just roll their eyes and go, well, like every day, buddy, just follow me around.
Alex, and as part of my research and background for the video course, I dug up a discussion on allnurses.com. All Nurses is the community site for nurses. And I found 77 pages of discussion.
Pages.
Versus pages. Not exactly. You know how a discussion board works. And so you can have an idea of how many threads and contributions amongst professional nurses themselves talking about end of life experiences. You know, that what happens around the moment before and after somebody has died.
Okay. Let me go back and poke you a little bit on this one, because you said, hey, it's not monolithic. Don't give up hope. You know, there are people in the medical field that are open to this. And in your investigation of this, you're keen to point out that Nobel Prize winners have come to this conclusion. Scores and scores of PhDs have come to this conclusion. There's more peer-reviewed research on the survival of consciousness hypothesis than ever before. But this is still an uphill battle. If you, this is still by far a minority opinion. Don't we have to be careful in kind of presenting this? And I think you are, and you're telling people that there is this problem out there. But I feel compelled a lot of times, because it's something that came to me and confronted me, is the how can this be question, right? So we sit there when we go, okay, we're going to fight the good fight. And yeah, the mainstream medicine is stupid and they're materialistic and reductionistic. Why? Why are they? Why do we have to fight so hard for what is obvious? You know, I mean, well, you just mentioned after-death communication, and I was recently chatting with Dr. Julie Beischel, and she was at this after-death communication conference, and she threw a little factoid at me that adds to this picture. You know, 60% of spouses who lose their partner
Agneta Grimberg, University of Uppsala, to be precise.
tell us, yes, about that study and what that means. If that's the case, why is it so hard to get this across? And we can't just say, oh, well, oh, they're sticking the muds. They don't want to change their opinion.
Alex, you're thick. I know you're naive, because you believe those 70% of people. You're talking about 70% of people who want to believe, who imagine things.
Recap that research for folks so they know what we're talking about.
That's just one of a stream of pieces of research telling us that people see, smell, feel, touch, have experiences of people who have recently deceased. The frequency of these experiences goes down dramatically. There's a time pattern, which, I mean, if these were just haphazard random events, you would not see time patterns. We see very identifiable time patterns telling us that first 48 hours, the highest incidence, and then they decrease. And that particular piece of research came from a Swedish university, Dr. Grimberg, who said that 70 odds, now I don't remember exactly the percentage of elderly bereaved spouses reported an experience of after-death communication. But this happens all the time. That's not the problem. Let me, before we get any further, let me perhaps suggest a possible answer to your question. You ask, how is it possible? And I think that part of the explanation is in the fact that what gets projected officially is not a majority view. The access, our friends, the ultra-skeptics, the leverage they have with the media and the public information is extraordinary. But I do not think...
Hold on. I got to interrupt you. It's not ultra-skeptics. Ultra-skeptics are the front men. They're the barking dog on the chain. This is mainstream medicine, mainstream science that wants it this way. Hey, you can't run their business with your airy-fairy alternative model. It doesn't make money. It doesn't make the trains run on time. It doesn't do any of that stuff. So forget about the skeptics. They're just the sideshow. The people behind the skeptics, mainstream medicine, wants this the way that it is. Science wants this the way that it is, or they're out of business otherwise.
I will certainly not contest that, but it is also true that research shows that belief in the paranormal, belief in the existence of psychic powers, I'm not sure about belief in survival, but certainly belief in the existence of telepathy, for instance, positively correlates with education. Is not the gullible, the stupid, and the ignorant. The PhDs are more likely to believe in the paranormal than the less educated people. And here again, I mean, I do not want to present this as a full explanation, but it's part of it. When we talk about the health profession, when we talk about the body of science as the scientists, as people who do science, we're not talking, as we said before, of a monolith. There are interests and there are differential accesses to means of information and you know, public platforms, etc. But I would be cautious in saying I do not believe that the majority of, if I look at my professional areas, I do not think that most health professionals are staunch materialists.
So, Dr. Kelvin Perosetti, you've put together this program, educational program, and you've hinted at why you think there's a scientific reason to believe that this can be effective in helping people overcome grief and bereavement. Now, in reading and listening to your explanation of this and you're talking about this, a couple of interesting points popped up because one of them, I'll just start with one of them. It's, you make the point that you get out of it what you put into it. And you say that's not just a kind of good axiom, but that there's scientific evidence for the fact that if you work at this, you're likely to have results. But if you don't work at it as much, you're less likely to have results.
Excuse me, that's exactly what happens in cognitive therapy. If you do not identify your wrong, distorted, excessively negative thoughts, and if you do not work at correcting them, your moods do not improve. On the other hand, we have research, particularly by Kenneth Ring and his collaborators, Kenneth Ring, one of the pioneers of near-death studies, and he showed something which I found phenomenally interesting, and it's fueled my enthusiasm for the approach I developed. And as we all know that NDEs show an array of beneficial psychological and behavioral changes. If you've had an NDE, 25 years later, those changes are still as prevalent and as evident as they were at the time of the experience. I'm talking about, you know, loss of interest for material things, an increase in interest for non-material things like knowledge for its own sake and the desire to help. There's a number of psychological health indicators improve after an NDE. What was extraordinary is that Ring showed that some of these changes appeared in people who did not have an NDE, but just read about it. And the size, the entity of these changes was proportional to the time and the effort the people put into studying NDE. You see how I came to, very simply, to put again two and two together and say, correct negative thoughts and you will feel less bad. When I say correct negative thoughts, I'm not talking about swapping one belief for another belief, right? I'm not presenting my patients and my readers and my public with a new Bible or a new holy book that demands to be accepted as a matter of faith because I have whatever little qualifications I have. No, that's absolutely not the point. The point is to exercise the faculty of judgment. Do look at the evidence, go through the process of learning, questioning, judging, come out with your own judgment on whether or not evidence seems to support survival of death. It is that process that makes people feel better. They're not, because I mean, if I were to play guru, you know, spiritual leader or whatever, and tell them, ooh, don't worry, you don't die, your spouse, your child, they're still alive somewhere, believe me, because I know it. That might have an effect, but we know that the effect is of very short duration. If people internalize these concepts because they have looked themselves at the evidence, they've educated themselves, they have exercised their rational faculties, that's the way to change thoughts. That's the way to correct a faulty thought process.
And didn't I also read that you plan on collecting some data that you might use going forward in this in terms of figuring out how effective this cognitive behavior therapy wrapped into an online course, self-paced, that anyone can take?
Actually, with my friend Gary Schwartz, whom I know you've interviewed at least a couple of times, and it's a well-known personality in this field, we had even started the process of getting authorization to have this approach tested in a clinical setting. But then he's a very busy man, and I was a little intimidated by the spectacular amount of bureaucracy that's needed to start an experiment. We would do a double-blind study, you know, so the simplest thing, you know, a group of equally bereaved people would go through normal counseling procedures, another group would go through this approach, and we would see what happens. I still think this is not only possible, but it's highly, highly desirable, and it would be great if, you know, a PhD student wanted to take this up as a possible dissertation subject. However, let me say this. This entire initiative is, first of all, important to know it is not for profit. I personally am not making a penny out of this. And the manual and the course are distributed through the Forever Family Foundation. And the Forever Family Foundation is one of, frankly, the brightest examples of the fact that this field is moving. Is a non-religious, not-for-profit organization, which is strong of, as last count, over 12,000 members worldwide. And if you look at the scientific advisory board, you will see a few names you certainly know. And what's truly interesting is that they are collecting data. They're not collecting data yet, because I mean this resource is just going out now as we speak, but for years they have been collecting data. And this is purely anecdotal data, but you know, I'm a strong advocate of the fact that denying the validity of anecdotes when we try to build a picture of reality is a major intellectual and methodological mistake.
Oh, moreover, I mean, any scientist will tell you that this is the precursor to further investigation. So it's so funny when anecdotes get degraded or, you know, I mean, no, that's how you start. You start with observing the world and
ignorance. Sorry, I mean, really, it's terrible. Anyhow, the foundation has been, basically, the foundation is the organizational embodiment of this movement towards continuing bonds, right? Continuing bonds is the new is the new thinking in bereavement counseling. The idea is that, you know, don't think that your loved one has disappeared, right? And of course, there are more conservative approaches. The foundation embodies the more radical approach that says, no, that they're still alive. They're still here.
The more reality-based approach, but go ahead, radical, reality-based.
Very enough, very enough. And as part of that, and through their afterlife discussion groups and seminaries and beautiful events, I've been to a couple myself, and that's very interesting because you have bereaved people, the very quote-unquote material you're working with, coming together, discussing their own experiences amongst themselves, discussing how their experiences of communication, of contact with the deceased loved ones have helped them immensely. And all that is done with scientists or doctors or people who are active in this field. And so it's a very positive, very healthy, very non-sectarian exchange. There's, you know, religion is fully respected, but it's left out of the door. This is a dialogue between bereaved people themselves and with the participation, the inputs, the injections, if you want, and if needed, the support of specialists. A very, very interesting model.
How much does the course cost, and how do people find it and explore it?
The idea here is that people buy the workbook, and the workbook, I think, sells for $19.95. Which is, I believe, a pretty reasonable amount to invest, even for a trial. And for that amount, people do get the workbook and the access to 30 video modules on a dedicated section of the website. You know,
that's the
workbook is the tip of the iceberg. The big thing are the video lessons, which come as part of the package, and there's no more money to pay, nobody's making money here.
Fantastic. So we'll put a link up in the show notes, but just tell people what do they search in Google to find this?
The Amazon Love Knows No Death.
Love Knows No Death. Great. Forever Family will get you there too, probably?
Absolutely. ForeverFamilyFoundation.org.
Well, again, our guest has been Dr. Piero Calvi Parisetti. We've been talking about a new and very exciting course he's done on bereavement and grief and some of his other work. Dr. Calvi Parisetti, it's been awesome having you on. Thanks again so much for joining me.
My own pleasure, Alex. Thank you very much.
Thanks again to Dr. Calvi Parisetti for joining me today on Skeptico. One question to tee up from this interview: what do you make of his claim that education about near-death experience science and after-death communication can help the bereaved in a measurable way, can actually be a treatment that would rival drugs or conventional psychotherapy? What do you make of that? Let me hear your thoughts on that, of course, through the Skeptico website at skeptiko.com, where you can leave a comment right there or jump over to the forum and join the dialogue over there. While you're there, of course, you can download any of the over 300 previous episodes of Skeptico. You can subscribe to the newsletter or to the podcast through iTunes or Stitcher or whatever. And you can also find my email address if you want to drop me a note directly. Well, that's going to do it for this episode of Skeptico. Be sure to stay with me. I'm not exactly sure what the next show is, but I hope you stick around for it. Until next time, do take care, and bye for now.